Each week, American History TV sits in on a college lecture with one of the country's college professors. You can watch those classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 11 a.m. This week, we're back at American University for the second part of History Professor Alan Lichtman's class on President Franklin Roosevelt and his effect on the modern presidency. This is about 70 minutes.
In 1936, FDR is enthusiastically renominated by the Democratic Party in a convention that eliminates, as we mentioned, the two-thirds rule for nomination and makes nomination a simple majority. Roosevelt's acceptance speech was heard by millions on radio. And it articulated the basic theme of his reelection campaign, which was an affirmation of New Deal policy combined with a spirited attack on those he called the quote-unquote economic royalists who sought to concentrate power in their hands by creating an economic tyranny in the United States. These economic royalists, he said, complain that we seek the overthrow of the institutions of America. What they really complain about is that we seek to take away their power. How do you think Republicans responded to that kind of rhetoric? And it's exactly the way the Republicans today or yesterday responded to President Obama's call for higher taxes on the rich. What did they call it? Class warfare. And Roosevelt was not only initiating class warfare, but was a traitor to his class. You know, God, you're this upper class guy, and here you want to attack, you know, your fellow upper crust Americans. Roosevelt is a traitor to his class and was being accused of waging open class warfare. But Roosevelt knew what he was doing. Because who defines themselves as economic royalists? Not 90% of the American people. You're pretty safe attacking the economic royalists since no one really thinks that they fit into that particular category. And Republicans had a big problem, not only dealing with such a charismatic, politically brilliant president, but they had trouble with what? Much worse than the trouble they're having now. Finding a candidate. They had been shredded in three consecutive elections, 1930, 1934, 1936. They clung to small minorities in both houses of Congress. There were Republican governors in about a half dozen states with combined populations less than that of New York State. Didn't leave much in the way of presidential timber for the Republican Party. As one political analyst put it, you can't beat somebody with nobody. And FDR was a very big somebody going into the campaign of 1936. The Republicans decided they would look west for a candidate. You know, that the future of the party, and they were right, although not immediately, lay in the west, not in the east. And they chose this guy. Who is? Alf Landon. And who was he in 1936? Anybody else know?
Was he the governor of Kansas?
Governor of Kansas, the only Republican incumbent governor to survive the Democratic tsunami of 1934. And he was a decent man. I actually met him. Guy lived to be 100. And I actually, when I was in graduate school and doing my dissertation on the presidential election of 1928, I went out to Topeka, Kansas, and actually interviewed. I couldn't believe it. I'm actually interviewing a guy who ran against Franklin Roosevelt, you know, Alf Landon, a really nice guy. But, you know, as even his supporters said, he wasn't big enough to be president. You know, he just did not have the kind of stature and abilities, obviously, to compete with FDR. He had a lot of money. Republicans actually outspent the Democrats in 1936. That even with all his popularity and all his power, the business money was still primarily flowing to Republicans. Very interesting, a phenomenon that would continue throughout most of American presidential history. Barack Obama was one of the, and Lyndon Johnson were among the few Democratic presidents to get more money from the business world than their Republican opponents. But even in 1936, everyone knew Franklin Roosevelt was going to win, and you know he had so much power and was up against a weak opponent. Republicans still got more business dollars, still spent more money. He also had a lot of conservative organizations behind him. There was a lot of organization building on the part of the right because they so detested Roosevelt and so detested his policies. And in fact, it was during this period that you kind of had the forerunner of the modern, all-purpose, nationwide, conservative, independent political organizations. Anyone know what that was? It was called, not a surprising name, the American Liberty League. The American Liberty League, led in part, actually, by disgruntled Democrats, by the same group of Democrats who had opposed Franklin Roosevelt for the nomination in 1932, as well as conservative Republicans. And it was financed by, actually, mostly by one particular family, not the Rockefellers, but a family about as rich. The DuPonts. Exactly. It was the DuPont brothers who were the big money behind the American Liberty League. And it spent about $1 million, peanuts today, but very big money for an independent political organization in 1936. Although it's the forerunner of modern conservative organizations, it did not itself survive, for not surprising reasons, the election of 1936. Roosevelt's campaign manager was who? Anybody know? Very famous name. Yeah. No. Howe was out of the picture by this time. I think he had died by this time. Very, very familiar name to all of you. James Farley, the famous Politico of the New Deal. And he made a famous prediction, right? Anyone know what his prediction was? Most famous prediction in political history. FDR will rule in every state except Maine and Vermont. And guess what? FDR wins every state but Maine and Vermont. There used to be an old saying, because Maine voted first. It was an exception to the election laws to let Maine go first because of its tradition. And the old saying was, anyone know the old saying about Maine?
As goes Maine, so goes the nation,
that Maine was a harbinger. Well, Farley changed that to something else after this election. Anybody know what that was changed to?
As goes Maine, so goes Vermont.
Right. As goes Maine, so goes Vermont, which is exactly what happened in 1936. So an enormous ratification of Roosevelt the candidate and Roosevelt's policies. So let's stop and take stock. You had all of these first New Deal programs followed by the second New Deal. You had enormous Democratic majorities piling up. You had Roosevelt changing the nomination process. What were some of the fundamental ways in which Franklin Roosevelt, during his first term, changed American politics, changed American policy, and changed the presidency? Start anywhere. Very good point. For the first time, really, Franklin Roosevelt changed people's expectations of government. Yes, people before thought, had this overestimation of presidents that they could effectively manage the economy. But Franklin Roosevelt really, for the first time, cemented in the idea that the president and his administration were responsible for producing a prosperous, growing, and full employment economy. In other words, people now evermore expected their government to be the final guarantor of responsibility for the economy and for jobs, and would blame the government when that didn't happen. Very important shift in the nature of the relationship between the government and the economy and the expectations of people of their government. But there was a paradox that lay at the core of these new expectations and continues to haunt American politics to this day. So the American people expect all these things of their government. But what do they also want? Pardon? No taxes, limited government, no government pressure on them. Self-help. So at the same time they have these enormous expectations of government, they also, at least rhetorically, expect limited government, low taxes, fiscal responsibility, and a government that doesn't interfere with their daily lives. Fundamentally contradictory expectations. So everybody believes in cutting government, having limited government, except for what? What does nobody want, even though they want limited government and government cuts?
They don't want cuts in welfare spending?
Well, they don't want cuts in anything that benefits them. There's a wonderful article either today or yesterday in one of the newspapers talking about Eric Cantor. Anyone know who Eric Cantor is? Who is he? Majority leader from Virginia. And what happened in Virginia recently? Natural thing. It was an earthquake, right? And the people in his districts are demanding what? To help with the damage and problems from the earthquake.
Money.
From who?
Government.
Which government?
The federal government.
Uncle, exactly. Uncle Sam, the government has got to step in and help here. And, you know, here is, you know, one of the biggest advocates of cutting government spending, you know, limited government. So, you know, we are living with this paradox from the days of Roosevelt to today, of people expecting all these things from government, yet at the same time, you know, this core belief in limited government, no taxes, fiscal responsibility. And this also leads to a second point. Not only are people expecting their government to establish prosperity and jobs, but you mentioned they're also expecting their government to do what?
To provide for their welfare.
To provide for welfare, exactly. So to provide for the elderly, you know, I don't care how conservative someone on Social Security and Medicare may be, and of course Medicare is a later program, but the principle is the same. What's the one thing they will never, ever support cutting? Social Security and Medicare, you know. If you're a farmer, you know, big farm, the last thing you'll ever support cutting is farm subsidies. And, you know, there was a very famous conservative senator from North Carolina. Anyone know who that was? Really, Mr. Conservative.
Yeah. Jesse Helms.
Jesse Helms. And what was the one big government program that Jesse Helms would always promote and always support? Tobacco subsidies. You know, probably the most pernicious, the worst government program you could possibly imagine. But of course, the tobacco farmers are in North Carolina, so he is for. And that's one of the reasons you can't cut agricultural subsidies. You have all these senators, many of them very conservative from agricultural states, who the last thing they want to see cut is agricultural subsidies. So you not only have now new responsibilities on the part of the government for the general economy, you now have new responsibilities on the part of the government for individual and family well-being and welfare. How else does the New Deal change politics, policy, and the presidency? We've got two big areas. What are some of the other things that the New Deal instituted in the way of changes? Yeah.
Like what social groups made up the support centers for the political parties?
Very important. You have an utter transformation in the nature of political coalitions in the United States. First of all, the Democrats do become, by the end of 1936, the majority party in the United States. They hadn't been the majority party in America since when? When was the last time the Democrats? Yeah, before the Civil War. You have to go back before the Civil War to find a time when the Democrats were the majority party in the United States. This is a huge critical realignment. When we talked about critical realignments, transformational elections. So now the Democrats become the majority party in the United States, and to this day, in a sense, are the majority party. That is, more people identify to this day as Democrats than Republicans, although that majority is much weaker than it was during the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. Not only do they become the majority party, but they forge a brand new coalition under FDR, sometimes known as the Roosevelt Coalition. Who are the elements of the Roosevelt Coalition? What kind of coalition does Roosevelt put together to transform American politics? Yeah? Who's in it?
Doesn't he have a thing called the unofficial African-American cabinet?
First of all, African-Americans. Probably the biggest change is that the Democratic coalition brings in African-Americans. Why is that such a monumental change in American politics?
Because they were the pro-slavery party during
yes.
the war.
Yes. You know, African-Americans, up until this time, were the most loyal Republicans. It kind of didn't matter. The Republicans were the party of whom? Lincoln. The Democrats were the party of the Copperheads, you know, who opposed the Civil War and Reconstruction. So this was an enormous transformation that begins in 1934, in 1936, and to this day, there has not been a single presidential election in which African Americans voted other than Democratic. And really, from the 60s on, it's, you know, 90%. They're the strongest element today of the Democratic coalition, but they were a new element of the Democratic coalition that Franklin Roosevelt put together. So that's one element. Who else? We've talked about some of them.
Well, labor.
Labor becomes a very important element, particularly as labor union membership is rising throughout the 30s and into the 40s, labor becomes in many ways the backbone of the Democratic Party. And a lot of the story of the decline of the Democratic Party in the late 20th and 21st century has to do with the decline of the labor movement. In fact, what's one of the first things some of the new Republican state governments did after they came into power after the 2010 election? What did they go after?
Collective bargaining
and labor unions, particularly the strong today. What is the strongest element of the labor movement? What types of unions?
Public
what
sector.
Public sector unions, and that's exactly what they went after. That was that huge controversy in Wisconsin. So labor is a second very important component, along with African Americans. Yeah.
Farmers?
Not so much. I mean, farmers kind of, you know, are a swing vote, but you couldn't say. You know, he did better among farmers, certainly the Democrats had done before, but they never became a core element the way blacks and union members were. The South. So you have the paradox of the New Deal coalition or the Roosevelt coalition or the New Democratic coalition putting together African Americans and the white South that at this time was still segregated. That had the system of Jim Crow discrimination against African Americans. But Roosevelt was able to keep the South, despite having African Americans in his coalition, as we've talked about, by not doing what?
He didn't come out as being for or against civil rights.
Civil rights. Exactly. He had no civil rights program. And basically, the deal was the South, the white South, because, you know, blacks hardly even voted in the South, held no political offices, held almost no appointive offices, had no place in the justice system in the Jim Crow South of the 30s. The deal was FDR would let the South manage its own race problem, would not interfere at the level of the federal government, and in turn, the white South would do two things. Vote for him, and Democrats, of course, since it was a one-party South at that time, except for African Americans primarily, vote for Democrats and FDR in national elections, and support his New Deal programs in the Congress because many of the important committees were controlled by Southerners. Why were Southerners so out of proportion represented in important congressional committees?
Well, they didn't really have competitive elections after the primaries, so
exactly.
Once they're in, they're in.
So you're in, it's very hard to get you out because only Democrats get elected, and so, as they say, the primary is tantamount to election, and it's hard to beat an incumbent in the primary. So that was the deal. FDR would not interfere with race relations, would not push a civil rights program, and in turn, the white South would provide him and the Democrat votes and support for his New Deal programs, at least during his first term. And the New Deal was a great deal for the South. Why? Why was it such a good deal for the South?
Well, because it would, like, rebuild a lot of infrastructure that hadn't been addressed since.
What's the poorest area of the country?
South.
The South. And as the poorest area of the country, it contributed the least in taxes and got the most in benefits. For example, as you say, a lot of infrastructure building was in the South. A lot of the rural electrification under the New Deal was in the South. And, of course, African Americans did not join the Democratic Party because of civil rights. Why did they join the Democratic Party? Yeah.
Because the New Deal programs were working for them, even though Roosevelt didn't really have a civil rights agenda.
Exactly. Although a lot of the New Deal programs are very discriminatory, you know. For example, Social Security did not include farm labor, and a lot of African Americans in the South worked on farms. Didn't include household labor. A lot of African American women worked in the household. Nonetheless, for the first time, at least something was being done to improve the lot of African Americans, and they saw the Republican Party as a white man's party now, as a party, you know, as things began to shift, particularly in the North, as a party that just wasn't interested in programs to help African Americans any longer. You know, maybe during the Lincoln era, but in the 30s, they didn't see the Republican Party offering much of an alternative. And certainly, the economic policies of the Republican Party didn't seem to offer much to blacks. So you had the white South, you had unions, you had African Americans. Who else? Yeah, urban ethnics, the Irish, the Italians, the Jews. Urban ethnics were the final element of this very disparate New Deal coalition. You know, you had groups that, you know, did not necessarily easily harmonize and coalesce, but nonetheless, FDR was able to cobble together, because they all had interests in what he was doing, and he was such a master of political maneuvering, that he was able to put together this very diverse coalition and establish it as the majority coalition in the United States, an extraordinary accomplishment. What else? How else did he change? We pretty much got the politics down. We've got two important elements of public policy. What else?
Well, he kind of changed, like, maybe what the debate was about. Because from the Kennedy era, was about the thing with Roosevelt, it's now about the scope of government.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things you do in a transformation, like Andrew Jackson did or Thomas Jefferson, is you move the whole center of politics. You change the whole conversation. As you'll see, people would commonly use that to describe Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan changed the whole conversation about politics. Instead of the conversation being what can government could do, Reagan changed it to what problems does the government cause. And now Franklin Roosevelt changed the whole conversation about politics. It's very difficult to talk in terms of the conservative politics of the 1920s anymore, after the New Deal and the political triumphs of FDR. What else?
Change in expectations regarding the president as initiator of legislation.
Absolutely. Now we're beginning to talk about some changes of the presidency itself. It's not that other presidents didn't initiate legislation. Woodrow Wilson did, Theodore Roosevelt did, but none kind of led and directed the national agenda on policy as much as FDR. He really, you know, does anyone even remember who the leaders of Congress was? Maybe a political junkie like you do, Zach, but most people have no idea who the Speaker of the House or, you know, the majority leader, you know, his name Joe Robinson, these names don't mean anything to anyone, because FDR was so much at the center. It was the Roosevelt's New Deal program, which is not entirely true, because there were very important figures, notably Senator Robert Wagner, who were very important in forging a lot of New Deal programs. But nonetheless, more than ever before, legislative leadership came to be identified with and focused upon the presidency, which both expanded presidential power and created political jeopardy for presidents who, for example, like Jimmy Carter, were unable to deliver on those promises and expectations. What else regarding the presidency or policy? One area,
The federal government was now an active participant in the economy. There were regulations, there were rules.
Exactly. Federal government becomes much more of an active participant in the economy and in people's lives, and something we haven't discussed, not only providing social welfare, not only operating fiscal policy and monetary policy to achieve prosperity, but now regulating business. You now had a Securities and Exchange Commission for the first time to regulate the securities market, for example. You now had new regulations and regulators for banks. So in a way that had never been the case before, the industrial and financial economy of the United States was now being regulated by the federal government. So in addition to taking on responsibilities for social welfare, for prosperity, the federal government was also expected to curb the abuses of business and also to counterbalance business power with labor power. Remember, unions did not arise in the 30s only by their own effort, although that effort was very important. They were directly nurtured for the first time by the federal government with the passage of the Wagner Act or the National Labor Relations Act. How do these new agencies and new involvement of the federal government expand the power of the presidency as well, specifically the presidency? Yeah.
Well, the presidency lost a lot of the conservative tendencies, had a conservative in the traditional sense, in that up until this point, we're talking about the Washingtonian ideal and how presidents have always tried to emulate that and live up to that. And, like, we'll get there more, like, for the next election. But, like, from Roosevelt giving the speech, the fact it was changed the inauguration date after him, it's the people just kind of basically forgot about the idea of, like, harking back to Washington.
Yeah, the kind of the remote, you know, kind of president who deferred to tradition, who didn't impose himself, is gone by now, replaced by the new interventionist activist president. It's another way, too, in which a lot of these new agencies change the power of the presidency.
It greatly increased the size of the federal government.
Right, and who's appointing all of these new officials?
President.
The president, exactly. Who's appointing the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the head of the TVA, the head of the FDIC, the head of the NRA? It's the president. So now you have all of these new executive agencies under the control and appointment power of the presidency, enormously expanding the reach of the presidency over particularly the business life, but generally the life of the nation in a way that simply had never before been the case. Yeah, there were some regulations before that, but never the kind of detailed regulation, particularly of business and finance, that had been instituted under the New Deal and that at least nominally was under the control of the presidency. On the other hand, there's a downside to this enormous growth of the government and of federal agencies. What's the downside for the president?
Doesn't it put him at more risk for scandal?
Certainly that. Absolutely. There's even a bigger kind of problem here for the president.
There's a lot more expected of him.
A lot more expected and
a lot of red tape now.
Well, yeah, you know, the government becomes much, much more difficult to manage. You know, when you got a small government with limited functions, you know, a president can pretty much be on top of things. But as the government grows, as the number of agencies grows, the number of appointments grow, not only is there more room for scandal, and the Roosevelt administration was hit by scandal, particularly in the WPA and some other federal agencies, and expectations rise, but the management problem of the presidency enormously expands. And the ability of the president to actually manage and control what he seems to have power over actually becomes much more difficult. So this is, you know, one of the great paradoxes of the modern presidency. As the scope of government and the ability of the president to make appointments and establish agencies and issue executive orders expands, the management problem becomes so much more difficult. And as you'll see, FDR, during his second term, does directly address that issue. And finally, you know, we've all talked about this, but, you know, just to sum it up, in terms of the politics, the president also makes politics more direct, more personal, more democratic, eliminating the two-thirds rule for Democratic nominations, establishing the idea that the president personally goes to the convention and makes a speech that everybody listens to on the radio and then, of course, later on the television with his fireside chats, directly speaking to the American people, with the use of modern polling techniques, trying more directly than ever before to take the pulse of the American people. So, you know, in these ways as well, FDR contributes to the evolution of presidential politics as more direct, more personal, as a politics that has a more immediate impact. Remember, you know, in the old days, people just didn't see or hear very much of their president, certainly did not have this kind of direct, personal relationship. But of course, the tale of humanity is great power and great heights lead to great falls. And I don't mean the place in Virginia there. And FDR starts out his second term with certainly what appeared to be a great fall, and in some senses was. And that was his court packing scheme. What was that all about, and why was that an overreach? Way in the back.
He was, I forgot the traditional number of judges, but he increased the number of judges so they could vote for his policy.
Well, he wanted to increase the number of judges, yeah.
He wanted to outnumber the conservative votes on the court by creating a bunch of new seats that you could then fill with liberal judges using some arcane paper filed by one of the justices.
Yes, yes, we all vote yes. The Roosevelt yes men on the court. Anybody want to further expand that? Did you have?
No.
Yeah. So here's the idea. He is terrified that the Supreme Court's going to do what? Yeah, pretty much strike down, particularly the Wagner Act and the Social Security Act, the two pillars of the New Deal, right? These are, you know, the two most important things, both substantively and politically, and also the WPA, very important substantively and politically as well. But, you know, the Wagner Act and the Social Security Act are kind of the real strong, stout pillars of the New Deal. You know, one establishes labor power, the other establishes the new welfare state and entitlement programs. He cannot afford to have those struck down. And he's very fearful that the court's going to do that. And he thinks the only way he can stop it, look, you know, I just got elected with 46 states, only 48 in those days. I just got elected with 46 of 48 states. I've got, you know, 3/4 of the votes in the Congress are Democrats. I can do what I want. And I can even go after the courts. We discussed another president who went after the Supreme Court, didn't we? Who was that? Thomas? Yeah. And what happened to him?
Didn't work out.
Didn't work out. You know, the presidents don't do well when they joust with the courts somehow. It seems unseemly, you know, for the president to go after the courts. But Roosevelt felt it was worth it because he thought his whole New Deal program was going to be brought down, you know, like Samson bringing down the pillars of the temple and the whole structure crashing. So he proposed a scheme whereby for every justice who didn't retire at the age of 70 or more, which was a majority on the court, he'd get to appoint a new one. Remember, there was nothing sacred about 9 justices. We started out with 6. That's not a constitutional requirement. And so he felt in this way he could appoint, you know, 5, 6 new judges and literally pack the court with his yes men. What happened to the court packing scheme and why didn't it work?
Well, he didn't include Congress in any of this, so they kind of felt blindsided. So even his Democrats disagreed with it.
Exactly. He couldn't even get an overwhelmingly Democratic Senate to go along with this. Even Democrats in Congress thought this was overreaching, thought this was dangerous constitutional tampering, and this was FDR's first big political defeat and was not a particularly good way or an auspicious way to start the second term. What happened to the court, though? He loses the battle on court packing, but what happens? Yeah.
Ironically, they don't vote on the more conservative line. They don't really strike down his policies. They end up supporting him.
Exactly. One of the judges who was thought to be against him switched, and the court upholds the major New Deal programs. Some call it the switch in time that saved 9. It was a pretty good line, although a little bit hard to say. And so he loses the court packing battle, but ultimately wins the battle over the court. And ultimately comes to control the court the old-fashioned way. How?
A new judge
Yeah, he winds up appointing a slew of new judges, and basically, by the time he leaves office, it's an entire Roosevelt court, although not all the judges turn out precisely the way he wants them. But basically, he gets to reshape the court over time anyway. And this is really important because this constitutional fight, this transformation of the court, is critically important for the presidency and the political history of the country, because it basically validates the notion that the government can adopt major social policy, like Social Security, like the Wagner Act, that fundamentally transforms the nation, and the Supreme Court is not now going to step in and stand in the way. So this really, without this, you might, you know, who knows how different the course of American history would have been. You might not have had some of the fundamental reforms of the New Deal and of later years. And ultimately, too, this new stance upon the court also allows latitude constitutionally for the civil rights laws of the 1960s. Without this constitutional revolution, under old Supreme Court doctrines, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 might well have been struck down by the court. So Roosevelt loses the battle over the court, takes a big political bruising, but wins the war over the court. And we have this huge fundamental constitutional transformation, which is absolutely essential to the further evolution of the liberal state, both in regard to economic and social policy, and then later on in regard to civil rights policy as well. Same time, the crisis for Jews in Germany is getting worse and worse as Hitler's persecutions not only increase, but begin to spread to other areas, particularly after Hitler takes over Austria in 1938. His native country, brings in several hundred thousand more Jews into Germany. And Hitler's anti-Semitic policies are beginning to spill over into other countries where there are many more Jews than Germany, like Poland, which had over 3 million Jews. And after his reelection, for the first time, you get a new Roosevelt on the Jewish issue. He does begin to do things. Doesn't, you know, get up there and make big speeches about Hitler, but he does finally loosen the restrictions for immigration after his reelection so that the quota of 26,000 plus a couple of thousand for Austria does get filled during his second term. And his biggest initiative relates to his belief that you've got to extract the Jews from Germany and perhaps extract the Jews from other parts of Europe as well. That he comes around to the belief during his second term, freed of re-election pressures, that the only solution to the problem of the persecution of Jews in Germany and as it's spreading more broadly in Europe is to get them out. There's nothing you can do to stop Hitler and like-minded dictators from persecuting the Jews. The United States has no leverage. You know, we're not going to invade Germany. We have no army anyway. You know, we have limited exports with them. They don't respond to moral suasion. So his idea is, let's extract the Jews. And the problem is, you can't bring them into the United States because the immigration quota is only 26,000 plus a couple of thousand for Austria. That's, you know, a drop in the bucket. And what's the only way you could change the quotas? Yeah.
Congress?
Yeah, you have to go to Congress. And is that a promising thing to do? Why not?
They weren't favorable to that idea at the time.
You know, the Depression is still going on. There's no chance in the world Congress is going to open up the doors of America to immigrants. If anything, if you went to Congress, what was a more likely result?
They'd say to cut off all immigration.
They'd cut off all immigration or at least cut the quotas. So that wasn't an option. So you can't bring them into the United States except, you know, in small numbers. So what can you do?
Encouraging other nations to take.
Exactly. Let other nations, particularly underpopulated nations, take them in. And what's the big underpopulated area that could take in a lot of Jews? And I'm not talking about Palestine, because that's a whole other issue that's under the control of the British, and I'm not going to get into that. But what's the area of the United States has some influence that's huge and sparsely populated?
Alaska.
Pardon?
Alaska.
Not Alaska yet. Even, you know, Alaska's tough. More hospitable than Alaska.
South America?
Latin America, exactly. Latin America, you know. They could use, you know, skilled labor. They're very underpopulated. They have a lot of land. You know, they're kind of under our influence. So Roosevelt takes the initiative of calling a major international conference on refugees at Evian in France, and brings Latin American countries there, along with the US and Canada and Britain and France, in an effort that to try to get these Latin American countries to step up and take hundreds of thousands, even millions of Jews. What is the result? Pardon? I can't hear you.
They say no.
Exactly. They all express their sympathy, but they all say, but, you know, we already have enough. Our economies are too struggling. We can't afford it. It's a wonderful article in the Washington Post on the Evian conference that calls it the but for conference. Yes, we would like to help the Jews, but for, and fill in the blank. One country agreed to take in large numbers of Jews. Anyone know what that was?
Brazil.
No? Even, you know, a tiny fraction of the size of Brazil.
Chile?
Pardon?
Chile?
Much tinier than Chile.
Uruguay?
Nope, you're all guessing.
The Dominican Republic.
The Dominican Republic. Headed by whom? Was he a nice guy? No, he was one of the most bloodthirsty dictators in a, you know, an era of bloodthirsty dictators. He didn't have the power of Hitler, but if he did, you know, he might not have been quite as bad, but he would have been mighty bad. He was responsible for the murder of who knows how many, certainly more than 10,000 Haitians in the Dominican Republic simply because of their race. A horrible guy. Why would he want to take in Jews?
He could kill them?
No, he wasn't going to do that. That wasn't quite that bad. Think about it. He had just been, yeah. What does he want to do? Yeah.
Free labor? Or like cheap labor?
Part of that is good skilled labor, but improve his image. You know, he's this bloodthirsty murderer, but I'm going to curry favor with the U.S., right? I'm going to improve my image. I'm going to be the savior of the Jews. And, of course, does it work out? No. A few hundred Jews ultimately come to the Dominican. But, you know, that's just an indication of how bad things got at Evian. And, you know, FDR tried, but he was stuck. And then ultimately, the Jewish problem would become merged within what problem? World War II and the lead up to World War II. And, you know, this huge controversy that we're not going to try to resolve to this right now over, you know, did Roosevelt do enough? Did he not do enough to help the Jews? And, you know, the simple answer is, did he do everything possible? No. Did he do more than any other world leader, including Winston Churchill? Yes. Far more than any of them. Could he ultimately have stopped the Holocaust? No. The United States didn't have troops on the ground in Europe, except for Italy, until when? Come on, you all know. June of 1944, and then it took months to consolidate. But we'll talk a little more about this when we get to the World War II period. So by 1937, 1938, attention is beginning to shift. You know, the first term is all about the Great Depression, domestic policy, changing the fundamental politics and policies of America. But by the time you're getting towards the middle of the second term, foreign policy is becoming extremely important and would soon come to dominate domestic policy. But in the meantime, as Roosevelt is going into the midterm election year of 1938, he suffers another setback in top of the court packing setback, and it's evident from this chart. What's the setback he suffers in 37, 38?
He starts cutting government spending, which yep. leads to a drop in GDP.
Right. You get it kind of what's called, you know, today we talk about the double dip recession. This is the recession during the Depression. You can see up to that point, you know, up to 37, recovery is extremely robust. And you're right around again the levels of 1929. You know, basically the economy had recovered from the Great Depression. The myth is, you know, that only World War II brought the United States out of the Depression. That's not true. You know, we're pretty much out of the Depression. And look at that line, but by 1937, but then you get the recession within the Depression. Because most economists think, and you know, who knows if they're right, you know, in Washington, D.C., there's an economist on every street corner, and none of them agrees with any other. So you never know what the right economic wisdom is. But, you know, most who study this believe, you know, it was the cutbacks that certainly were part and parcel of the downturn. The conservatives at the time, of course, disagreed. What did they say the problem was with the economy? And things never change. Spending beyond the budget and too much debt. Side taxes and spending, too much regulation, exactly. This is what you'd expect. Of course, it hadn't happened for, you know, 4 years, 5 years. This is what you'd expect in an overtaxed, overspent government that overregulates. As I said, arguments never change. And of course, the liberals said it's because of cutbacks in spending. And because, you know, we still have this problem of income being so heavily concentrated in the rich who weren't spending enough. But this was a huge problem because in this new era, who gets the blame? The president. And this is heading right into the midterm elections of 1938. And what happens in the midterm elections? Democrats take a huge pasting. Lose scores of seats in the House and many seats in the United States Senate. Not enough for Republicans to come anywhere close to the majority again, but enough to make the Republicans, for the first time in the Roosevelt presidency, a very consequential majority, particularly given the fact that what group of Democrats is now beginning to sour a bit on the New Deal? The Southerners. And they're particularly souring on what's the last big piece of New Deal legislation, kind of the final act. What is that piece of legislation that's very important at this period in 38 that the South hates? It's nothing to do with civil rights, although it has a lot to do with race. One of you mentioned it previously. I think you did. What wouldn't Republicans like the government to do? The fair, yeah. Go ahead.
The Fair Labor Standards Act.
And that did what?
It created the National Labor Relations Board.
No, that was earlier. No. What did the Fair Labor Standards Act create? Something, again, that we've got lots of arguments over. The minimum wage and the maximum hours. And why did the South hate the minimum wage?
Because they could pay whatever they felt. Like without any
regulation. Exactly. They had a dual labor market, one for whites and one for blacks. And as low as it was, the minimum wage at least established a minimum floor. Although, again, many, many blacks who are in domestic labor or farm labor are excluded. But, you know, with the Fair Labor Standards Act, you know, the South was beginning to sour a bit on the New Deal. So, you know, I had Republicans as a consequential majority and Southerners in the Congress upon whom the president could no longer fully count. So, by 1938, the president's power in Congress had been weakened. The New Deal as a major domestic reform had pretty much run its course, and attention was being shifted to foreign affairs. You know, by the mid to late 1930s, what was happening abroad? What were some of the huge events that the president had to respond to in the mid to late 30s?
Japan had declared war on China.
Or had invaded China, exactly. I'm not sure they declared war, but they certainly had invaded China, and there was a big, horrible, bloody war. Absolutely right.
Germany was just moving place they wanted to be.
Germany was expanding, first in Austria, and then where? Czechoslovakia. What else? was going on in the world. Those were two huge things.
Civil war in Spain.
Civil war in Spain that seemed to pit Russia against Germany and Italy. Italy's invasion of Ethiopia, the pretty much demise of the League of Nations as an effective mechanism of international relations. And what was the reaction of the Congress of the United States to this eruption of world crises?
They were still very isolationist.
And so what did they enact?
There were neutrality acts.
Neutrality acts, right. Basically designed to keep the United States what?
Out of war.
Out of war and basically uninvolved with these quarrels in Europe. You know, critics of the time said these were acts perfectly designed to keep the United States out of World War I, which by this time most Americans thought it was a mistake for the United States to get involved in World War I, and most Americans wanted to keep America out of foreign crises. And time again, starting in 1935 through 1938, against Roosevelt's wishes, Congress passed a series of neutrality acts, pretty much tying the hands of the president, making it very difficult for the president to respond to foreign crises because he couldn't make distinctions between aggressors and victims. And Congress had also rejected something else that Roosevelt wanted, and that was American participation in the world court. We were not members of the League of Nations, but we could still be members of the world court. And Roosevelt, who understood the dangers abroad and was not an isolationist, was an internationalist and wanted America more involved, gets rebuffed. Congress won't ratify America joining the world court and keeps trying to handcuff him with restrictive legislation. It is not until the outbreak of World War II in September of 1939, after that, that Roosevelt is finally able to persuade Congress to at least in some limited way revise the neutrality laws. And he barely gets it through the House. He's got pretty adamant Republican opposition and some isolationist Democrats opposed as well. It's very, very narrow passage of the reform revision to give the president more discretion with respect to the Neutrality Acts and greatly increase the power of the presidency and the ability of the president to respond to foreign crises. But it was a very close call. And again, who knows how U.S. and world history might have shifted in fundamental ways if the United States had not repealed the neutrality laws, which gave the president some freedom, not full freedom as yet, to intervene on behalf of the victims of Nazi aggression in Germany. And this issue would become much, much more important in the presidential year of 1940, after Germany does what in the spring and summer of 1940?
Invades Poland.
Invaded Poland earlier, and you had the so-called phony war for a while, but then things changed. Right, when they swept across, what would they call that lightning German advance across Europe? The Blitzkrieg. And, you know, the world never seen anything like this, this lightning Blitzkrieg advance. And France thought they were protected by what? The Maginot Line, this series of fortresses. Germany says, ha, we'll just go right around that, who cares? And they march into Paris by June of 1940. So a whole new phase of crisis is now facing FDR, who's got to stay neutral. He can't get involved in the war, but he wasn't neutral. You know, Woodrow Wilson said, we'll be neutral both in fact and in spirit, and FDR said, you know, we'll just be neutral in fact. We're not neutral in spirit. It's quite clear, you know, that Germany and its allies represent a fundamental threat, not only to Europe, but to Latin America, where there's a lot of Nazi subversion going on. And ultimately, if the United States becomes isolated, to the United States itself and to the survival of democracy all over the world. So there's no question you know, that FDR wanted the power and the ability to aid the victims of aggression, but he faced a very, very powerful isolationist sentiment in the Congress and in the American public, and a very important isolationist organization known as the America First Committee, which took shape in 1940 to kind of push for American isolation. Their position was, we must never, under any circumstances, become involved in the European war. We don't care if Britain is going to go down along with France. That's not our quarrel. And their chief spokesperson was this guy, Charles Lindbergh. Who is he, and why did Americans care about him? Yeah.
First person to fly across the Atlantic solo.
And that made him?
Famous.
Yeah, he was the great American hero. And he was famous, you know, maybe, except for Roosevelt, the most famous of all Americans. You know, more people knew Lindbergh probably than anyone else. And people listened to him. And he became the public voice of the isolationist movement. And his arguments were very, very racial. Anybody know what, you know, how Lindbergh was making a racial argument about America's non-involvement in World War II? He made several of them, yeah.
That it's, that the danger is not Germans.
Correct.
The danger is Asia.
Exactly. That, look, this is a quarrel among the white civilized people of Europe. It's really unfortunate that the white civilized people of Europe should be fighting one another. And we certainly do not want to get involved in that and have more white civilized Christian people slaughtered. What a horrible thing. When we face, and he called them the Asiatic hordes, those are the real dangers. That's really where civilization is going to stand, and that was represented by Japan and by Russia. You know, Russia was considered an Asiatic country, you know, and of course, the menace of communism. And so he made a very racialized argument as to why America should stay out of the war, and he also made a religious argument with respect to the war. What was his religious argument? Who was pushing America to war?
He was seriously anti-Semitic, and he believed that the Jews were pushing a policy that wasn't good for Americans, so he segregated.
He even said that. He said, you know, this may be good for the Jews, but it's not good for America. You know, kind of saying Jews weren't real Americans. So it was the Jews that were pushing the United States into involvement in these European quarrels for their own selfish and non-American purposes. The Republicans, however, how much time is left?
11 minutes.
11 minutes, perfect. Get right to Pearl Harbor. The Republicans, however, didn't nominate an isolationist. Somewhat surprising. There were isolationists running, but they didn't have much popular appeal. So then they nominated this guy, one of the, you know, few true dark horse nominees in America. Just remember, a dark horse nominee is someone who unexpectedly gets the nomination. Who's this guy? Wendell Willkie, who held what political office? Trick question. None. What was he?
He was a businessman.
Businessman. And not an isolationist. It's a businessman who had, you know, kind of represented the business side of opposition to the New Deal, but not an isolationist. And as other nominees began to falter, he was supported by the non-isolationist Northern financial wing, Time Magazine and Wall Street, and came out of nowhere to win the Republican nomination. So the campaign in 1940 did not become an outright battle between Roosevelt the internationalist and Republican isolationists because of the nomination of Willkie. But meanwhile, Roosevelt took unilateral action as president to aid particularly Britain, who seemed very hard pressed to survive against the Germans. Does anybody know what he did unilaterally? That would be after the election. Yeah.
He gave them submarines, I believe.
Some what?
He gave them submarines.
Destroyers, exactly, because they had submarines and they were shrinking shipping. He gave them destroyers in return for some bases that Great Britain had in the Caribbean. He also persuaded Congress to begin a rearmament program, to begin rebuilding America's defenses, and luckily did not have great opposition from Wendell Willkie, who did not oppose these measures or the peacetime draft that Roosevelt helped initiate and get through Congress as well. But ultimately, as the campaign progressed, Willkie did make an attack on the president. He said the president is plotting and planning to send America into war. In other words, Willkie wasn't an isolationist, but of course he was opposed to America getting involved in the war. And as he saw the election slipping away from him, he did make the argument that you can't vote for Roosevelt or we'll get into war. Anyone know how Roosevelt responded?
And he pretty much promised that he wouldn't send anyone.
He absolutely promised, we're not going to get involved in the war. I'm not going to send American boys to die in an overseas war. Establishing, not for the first time, but further ratifying a fundamental premise that every time it's 100% guaranteed, I'll get to you in a second, that a president says, I'm not getting involved in a war during a campaign, what does he do immediately after? Gets us involved in a war. Woodrow Wilson, World War I, Franklin Roosevelt, World War II, Lyndon Johnson, the Vietnam War, George W. Bush, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, you name it, every president who's disclaimed any desire to get America involved in a war somehow manages immediately or shortly after the presidency to do just that, to get America involved in the war. Let me just switch here for one moment. Do we have the slide up? I don't know why I'm getting that thing, so it doesn't matter. Willkie gave Roosevelt a bit of a run for his money, doing obviously far better than Hoover or Landon, but still, Roosevelt wins by 10 points, wins pretty easily in the Electoral College, holds the entire South, as he would. Every single Southern state in all of Roosevelt's four elections voted for Roosevelt, usually by majorities of 60% or more. Willkie's strength is confined to the Plain State area and the Midwest, primarily. So it's a pretty thumping victory for Roosevelt. Certainly not a ratification of the idea that America should get involved in the war. But a ratification of this idea that Roosevelt pushes right at the beginning of his third term in office. And by the way, of course, the election of 1940 shatters what? The three-term tradition. Why was Roosevelt able to shatter the three-term tradition and win a third term? Something no one else had ever done?
I guess he broke the two-term tradition primarily because of his incredible charisma.
I'm sorry,
charisma.
I said three-term, I meant two-term.
Charisma and popularity.
That's part of it, but there's something more fundamental operating here.
The desire not to change in the middle of a war.
Exactly. I mean, we're not in the war, but the war is going on. The world is in flames. There's great peril. FDR is the reliable helmsman. Had there not been a war, the polls show that the nation probably would have voted Republican in 1940, and again, the course of history would have shifted. But FDR was able to break the two-term tradition of George Washington for the first time because of the war crisis and because of people's confidence that he was the most able leader to take us through war. Now, this is what someone mentioned this is what he did immediately after the war. It was of fundamental importance. What was this and why was it so important?
Well, didn't he basically give the British ammunition and ships?
Absolutely.
And they pay them back later, but yep. Basically to help them out, and it kind of established our alliance in the war.
Very good. Anybody want to expand on that?
Well, the British were running out of money. They could no longer afford to buy armaments and ammunition for the United States, so he extended them credit, basically,
right,
and let them get it for free.
Up until that time, the policy was called cash and carry. If you could buy arms from the United States and other supplies, but you had to pay for them. You couldn't get loans. You had to pay for them in cash and take them out in your own ships. And Roosevelt knew, as you say, that wouldn't work. You know, shipping was scarce on the part of Britain. They were in a fight for their lives. They're running out of money. So again, very narrowly, although not as narrowly as the repeal of the neutrality laws, and you can see the kind of opposition that it had, he said, we're going to make the United States the arsenal of democracy. Look, basically have three choices. We can let Hitler rule the world, and that's not acceptable. We can get involved in the war, and that's not acceptable. Or we can become, what did he call it? He had a name for this, the arsenal of democracy. We don't have to send our troops. We don't have to send American boys to be killed overseas. We can just send tanks and planes and boots and uniforms, the things that Britain and ultimately the Soviet Union, because a lot of Lend-Lease went to the Soviet Union, ultimately it was a huge amount of money, like $50 billion, an enormous amount for those days. And did we expect that money to be paid back? No, of course not. It was called Lend-Lease, but it was, in effect, the first massive American foreign aid program, first massive American military aid program. And, you know, Roosevelt had to steer it through, again, a lot of opposition. And there's no question that the Lend-Lease program was of fundamental importance for helping Britain and then later Russia resist Nazi and fascist aggression. One of the great paradoxes, though, of the World War II period is Roosevelt and most Americans always believed the greatest threat to America was not from Japan, but from Hitler and in Europe. After all, you know, American civilization was closest to European civilization. You know, Japan might threaten China or, you know, Indochina, Korea, but that's less important and less vital to the U.S. than France and Britain and places like that. And so the real, and it was also thought Hitler was more ruthless and more powerful. So always the United States was focused on the war in Europe. And increasingly, as 1941 wears on, the first year of Roosevelt's third term, the United States becomes somewhat involved in the war, at least in the Atlantic, trying to protect shipping going to Britain, and was pretty much uninvolved with events in the Far East, except it did something important with respect to Japan. And what was that? That antagonized the Japanese a lot.
The oil embargo.
The oil embargo, exactly. Embargoed oil, scrap metal, and other materials that the Japanese thought were essential. How much?
1 minute.
All right. I'm obviously not going to get to Pearl Harbor now. I'm just going to conclude, and next time we'll finish World War II and sum up what that meant for America, the presidency, and the world. I'll just conclude by saying that for many commentators, the war came to America through the back door of the attack on Pearl Harbor, which began a never-ending controversy over what?
Did Roosevelt know it was going to happen? Did he let it happen?
Did Roosevelt really want to get in the war? No. The only way we'd get in the war would be if our soil were attacked, and maybe he actually knew that they were planning to attack the American base at Pearl Harbor and let it happen in order to get us involved in the war. Most historians do not believe that, but there is no question that the precipitating event for American involvement in the war was the first major attack on American soil at Pearl Harbor since the War of 1812. We'll pick up Pearl Harbor and America's actual involvement in the war next time.